Well, brethren, one of the great mega themes of the Bible is man's incessant march toward chaos. It stands in stark contrast to God's intention for his children, which is an ordered paradise. Last time I was here, we talked about the garden and the fall of man. But today I want to discuss what I call the untrammeled trailhead of the journey of man and the journey God put mankind on in the restoration toward paradise. Our trailhead begins roughly 2,000 years after the creation, where we read the words, "Now the Lord said to Abram, get out." Before we discuss the trailhead of salvation's history, it is helpful to reflect on the backdrop where we hear the words, "get out" spoken. It's an environment, again, we went over some of this last time. I know it's been a while, but these are concepts and stories that we're very well familiar with. But God had created eastward in Eden a paradise. This is where God sought to put mankind. The paradise was pictured by a lot of different things. One of the hallmarks of that paradise was a peaceful relationship. It was the perfect, if you will, relationship between husband and wife. A peaceful one where there was transparency, there was unity, there was support, there was love, there was kindness, there was everything that God had created with his intention for mankind and a family specifically. But there was also peace between that couple and their God. They describe it as walking in the cool of the garden. And even, God knows what occurred, and he still comes through walking in the garden, says, "Where are you?" You know, and again, really to start mankind on the process of thinking about what they have just done. That's where it starts. There's a lot that went on during the fall of man, and again, we talked mostly about this last time. But fundamentally, what happened in the fall, mankind chose to depose God. They chose to move God out of his rightful position as the moral decider, the moral intellect, if you will, the superordinate position in their life of what was morally right and what was morally wrong. They chose to kick him out and say, "I will choose to do that. I will choose what is right. I will decide good and evil." So instead of man's orientation and their whole way of thinking being upward and noble, it became inward and corrupt. From there, the descent into chaos was almost inevitable, and it was brutal. Guilt, sorrow, suffering were almost immediate. The fundamental building block of society, the family, becomes dominated by contention, control, and power. Hatred, vengeance, violence, retribution, murder become the norm. And the lines of civilization become so corrupt that God says he was sorry he made mankind. And he declares them to be only evil in their mind, only evil continually. God finds one righteous man and through him preserves his creation. 1,600 years for that to occur through the flood. A few hundred years after the flood, we get the primitive story of the Tower of Babel, where once again, God's judgment falls upon mankind. Babel, or Babel, is the sad legacy of man's rejection of God as the ultimate sovereign. And it is the result of the long descent into chaos. Leading up to Babel is interesting because if we look at the first, and I'll say 11, but really the first chapter or two are really about creation, but the first 11 chapters of Genesis, the only hope anyone is given hangs on two promises. Think about that. For 2,000 years, what you're given, at least what is recorded for us, is two promises, fundamental promises. You can hang your hope on the fact that Satan's head would be wounded. And you can hang your hope on the fact that God says, I will never destroy the earth with flood again. For 2,000 years, the only blessings. Think about this again. I find it fascinating because we live close to 6,000 years into this. And we can go through the Bible. We can give message after message after message on hope and the greatness of God and all the things that are coming and all the plan of salvation. We can also go through and give you all the blessings God has showered upon you. And you are the recipients of them. For 2,000 years, they fundamentally, at least again, what was recorded and preserved for us, they had two blessings. They had the blessing that was given to Adam and Eve and Noah and his sons of procreation, saying, I will bless you. And they were. They were prolific. They had a lot of kids. And the population across the globe expanded rapidly. The other blessing that you can find in 11 chapters is the blessing of the Sabbath. And I think considering how civilization went, we could probably conclude they largely ignored that one. But that's where we are after 2,000 years. And it's here, again, we want to pick up the story. So turn, if you would, to Genesis chapter 11. Again, we're looking at the backdrop. We'll get to the good stuff here in a minute. The hope, the great trailhead of salvation. But it is so important for us to stop and consider, and so important that we frame up where God steps into humanity and we fully understand as best we can the condition, the environment in which God steps in. And again, the Tower of Babel is the last great story we get. Genesis chapter 11, we'll start in verse 1. It says, Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed from the east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. They had bricks for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, Indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do now. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them across or abroad over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of all the earth. And from there, the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. Again, it's a pretty straightforward story. I doubt I read anything there that you have not read multiple times. But there are some things that are worth noting. Because again, when we look at the environment, when we look at the time God chooses to step in and in a very visible way begin his plan of salvation, which was always in play, but mankind didn't see it. Mankind, and it wasn't self-evident until this environment is here. There are some things worth noting. This was a worldwide event, the confusion of the language. Again, we get the story of one of the significant and maybe one of the predominant tribes moving eastward and setting up a tower. But it says several times the whole earth experienced this. Which again, as people develop and cultures and families spread, it's very logical there would have been other tribes in other areas that would have also experienced the confusion of the language. Because again, it is a global event. It says the whole earth, all the earth had this happen to them. It's also interesting if you look into, kind of break down some of these words and you look into it. Speech here refers to the spoken word, whereas the language, because it says both were there, right? The speech is what the words, the sound that comes out of a mouth, if you will, whereas the language has more to do with meaning. And again, that's so instructive. The whole earth had one language, one meaning, one way of thinking. Their mind was such that they all were oriented in the same direction. And they all had the same language, the same speech, if you will. We would say that today they had a common ideology. They had one way of looking at the world, and it was all oriented in the same direction. They all had the exact same worldview. And we know how this can impact a society. We know how this can impact people in a culture, because we live in a time where they are trying to work on this. They are trying to control language. Why do they control language? Why do they control what you can and cannot say? Because they know it will change the culture. It will change minds. You can and will move entire societies based upon what you allow and what you don't allow them to say. And that's important to know. That's important, a important framework as we go through this message. Again, you control the language, you control culture. We don't often think of that, but there's the truth to that. And it is so important. This is such an important part of this story for us to remember, because it not only impacts us today, but it also impacts the environment, again, which God steps into. After their language was confused, and they scattered into these small groups and went their own ways, it says, scattered them across the whole face of the earth. In verse 9, the underlying mindset did not vanish. And that's worth us considering. The underlying premise that we read here in this story didn't go away. It was fragmented. It was separated. It was uttered in different words. It may even have a different approach. And it did. Again, we look around the world. There's lots of different approaches. But the underlying mindset didn't change. And that's, again, I think such an important thing for us to understand. It was essentially dispersed throughout the continents. It is then the idea, the mindset in Babel or Babel. I got to decide which way I'm going to say that, because I keep saying it both ways, so pardon me. But that underlying mindset is the foundation of every human government and every society. And we shouldn't, again, just broom that aside. Because at the end of the day, the difference is degrees of difference. The difference might be variability. The difference might be the smile on the face and the language that gets used to express it and the methods and the modes and the means to get there. But it's the same mindset. So why is it then? Why is it that they built a city and a tower? What was their primary motive? We read it just a moment ago. Again, we get a lot of hangovers, if you will, from the children's story and the children's version of this that we get told. It says their primary motive was to make a name for us, to make a name for themselves, so that they could be somebody, that they would be the prominent people on the earth and the land. That's why they built it. Again, there are other reasons, but that is the primary one. Verse 4, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves. That's their motive. That's the underpinning. Lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Socialism, communism, anarchy, monarchy, democracy, or any other form of government you can name. The difference is, again, in the approach. The difference is in how they seek out the exact same goal. And that exact same goal is power for them, power for ourselves, and to maintain control over the people. And we're going to start exploring this thought today, but it is worth a little bit of a sidebar for us to note and maybe even project ahead in our mind. Again, we will not be discussing this in depth today. But Christ's community, this church, and the church that God and Christ founded and has been in extent for almost 2,000 years now, is the opposite of Babel. It is the opposite of everything Babel pictures. And it needs to be so. This is not the community where we build a name for ourselves. We don't build edifices. We don't do things to accumulate power. Christ is the head of this church. And again, this is a sidebar, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But it's sufficient to say that Christ in his church is reversing every curse of Babel. And it is through this community that we need to begin that process. Revelation 7, 9 through 10, just note takers, all nations and tribes, tongues cry with the same voice. That time is coming. And we are the beginning of that. And that's why some of these stories are very relevant to us, even though today we're taking more of a historical context. Again, a bit of a sidebar. What is the system that was devised to control the people? What is the mechanism where they said, we need to get this power, we need to get a name for ourselves? It's embodied, if you will, or metaphorically represented by the city and the tower that they wanted to build. It is a well-known, I assume everybody here has seen pictures of a ziggurat. That's what they would have been building at the time. It's these sort of almost pyramidal-looking structures where at each level there's a terrace compound, and they successfully get smaller and smaller, leading up to the pinnacle. But each one has its terrace. Each one has its level. And in essence, it represents a spiritual caste system. Those on the top are super spiritual, and you kind of migrate down to the common plebes that just occupy the land. Those on top, then, of the temple, were the elite, were the righteous. And that's where whatever god they worshipped lived. It was the highest order of the priesthood. And it's interesting, too, because God says it reached into the heavens. It was a high point whereby it could overlook the entire city. It wasn't to avoid a flood. Again, they knew the story. It covered mountains. They were not going to build a tower tall enough to get higher than mountains. But they could overlook the city. They could sit on their moral high ground and look down on you and explain to you every moral wrong they thought you were doing. It is, in essence, putting false religion at the center of community life. It's also interesting a little bit, you could depend how you want to read this, but prior to the flood, you could almost, and you know, it's not emphatic, but you could almost articulate it was a fairly secular society. You don't see a lot of paganism. It's almost as though the lesson they took away from the flood, which, again, the stories would have been there, worldwide flood, one man living and his family, God's wrath, if you will, it seems like the lesson they might have taken away was to integrate a higher moral authority into their societies. So they build a tower. They build a temple in the center of community life. Now is a false religion. If religion was on the vertical axis, represented by the tower, the civil government was on the horizontal axis, represented by the city sprawl. And again, what was the purpose of all of this? To make a name for a few. The few that were on top of that tower and the few that controlled the people. It made them a name. It was there to keep the fragmentation that would naturally occur if you took out God from your own life, from the lives of the individual and the lives of the community. They were there replacing everything God should have been for the people. And again, as we go through these images, we try to craft that in our head. This is the environment God's looking into, and it's going to mature even more than this before God steps in. We have a city then whose design is to grant and give physical control over the people, to prevent them from moving out, to prevent them from being scattered, and you know, we need to gather you. Control. And then they had his tower, which had moral control, over the people and told them how to live properly. Again, falsely, because it was of their own mind. Another way of saying it, we have the unholy alliance of religion and state here. This, then, is the essential core of the Babylonian system. Rebellion, ambition, reputation, control, power, they had it all. And as I alluded to earlier, of significant importance in all of the primitive stories of the first 11 chapters, God gives no hope here. It's an interesting point that we shouldn't just walk past, because at every stage leading up to this, every key event, God steps in and offers hope. He offers hope to mankind. We see in the fall of man, Genesis 3:15, that he will bruise your head and you shall bruise his heel. There's hope in that, especially with what we know. I don't know what people would have understood in the first 2,000 years from that, but they would have understood something is going to happen. They would have started looking for something that was going to bruise the head of Satan and bruise the heel, the evil that was on earth. In the killing of Abel, in Genesis 4:26, we have Seth, that now they began to call on the name of the Lord. There's hope in that. There's somebody on this earth is crying out to God. Even after murder, there's hope in that. In the flood, Genesis 6:8, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord in the subsequent rainbow covenant. There's hope in that. Even in the worst of mankind, when God says their heart is evil only continually, he still found man and he preserved all of creation. There's hope in that. Tower of Babel, the birth of the Babylonian system, God offers no hope. Again, I find that in an instructive frame of mind, because we are left after Babel with disintegration, scattering, separation, and confusion. And brethren, again, we sometimes can read verses and, in about 12 seconds you can go right on to the next story and not realize that's how it was for almost 200 years after Babel. It was 200 years between Babel and Abram. And that mindset festered. That mindset grew. And it developed. And we'll see that here in a minute. All these city-states, imagine, language confused idea, but all the same mindset, all the same approach, all the same ideology spreading across the globe. And all these city-states forming, all of them descending into deep religious confusion. All of them, again, with the same underlying mindset of let us build ourselves a city and let us make a name for ourselves. And while the world, again, for 200 years, is experiencing all the confusion of Babel, God is quietly, secretly, undramatically working out his purpose. Because after about 200 years, down in the city of Ur of the Chaldees, there's a man and his family named Terah, and they decide to migrate to the land of Canaan. They make it as far as Haran via the Euphrates, and I guess just for orientation, Ur of the Chaldees is down southeast, Iraq, what we'd call Iraq today. Haran is up northern Syria, near the Turkey border a little bit, and of course Canaan is in the land of Israel. So here we have Terah, down in Ur of the Chaldees. And they go, we're going to go to Canaan. And again, they make it up as far as Haran. Both Ur and Haran were the completion, ideologically, of the Tower of Babel. Not the tower, the whole city of Babel, the whole system. Archaeologists will tell us this. One site that said they have over 100,000 tablets from these cities that explain what life was like. And they describe Babel. They describe towers. They describe the entire system that we would see in the story of the Tower of Babel, what we call a tower. But it's this whole city. It's a whole system. These two cities, Ur and Haran, were culturally rich. They had a wide, diverse, whole system of commerce and structure. And each city, both of these cities and many of the other cities in the area, were dominated by a temple tower, a ziggurat. They had built it. They had done, and actually that language, whatever spoken language they had, they went on and carried about and developed the very system that God was watching them build. They were economic in their environment. They had trade. They had culture. They had manufacturing. All of this, again, was designed to control. They had then built their city and their tower. It was devoid of God. It was heavily pagan. In fact, they said they had over 300 gods in that area. And each city was ruled by a strong man. It is then within this environment that God reaches down and touches one man. He touches a wealthy and comfortable city dweller and puts him at the trailhead of salvation history. The man Abram was chosen to begin the long process of redemption and salvation. In that environment, in that time, in that space, and I think it's, again, for many reasons, one of the great reasons it's so important to try to spend some time to look at the environment is to consider the man Abram. How hard, I say hard, I don't know, the story makes it sound, whatever, I'll do it. But it's important to understand where he was coming from, his background, and what he grew up in. Again, this wasn't a young man. I think it was 70 when God calls him. He's older than many of us in this room. And he would have been steeped in that environment. He would have watched. He would have been and had experienced the people and the priests at the top of the ziggurat issuing forth their commands. In fact, it's Jewish tradition, so don't take this as gospel, but I did find this an interesting tradition. But they actually believe that Terah got all his, because they were very wealthy, got his money from actually trading in idols, pagan idols. Now, if that's true, I find, again, that an interesting framework for us to read Genesis chapter 12, verse 1. And we'll just read three verses here. And again, this is the trailhead, or at least in the way I think of it anyway, this is the beginning. This is that sort of that, I almost envision it like a verdant green field where nobody's walked before. There's no path to follow. Abram's coming out of this world. He's coming out of this whole Babylonian system. God's saying, here, I want you to do this. I will show you where to go. I will get you there. Just trust me. Nobody's arguably done this before in 2,000 years of history. So again, it's a framework, I think, that helps as we read. We're only going to read three verses here. But said, now the Lord said to Abram, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. These words mark a fresh start in the narrative of the book of Genesis. And they sound forth the opening chords of the great oratorio of salvation's history. Think about just in three verses, the whole mindset difference that really we have from the first 2,000 years of recorded history for us. There's a complete shift here in God's stepping in for mankind. Three times in the first 11 chapters, God's judgment had fallen. We mentioned them earlier. Humanity was banished from the garden. They were destroyed by the blood, and then the diversity of languages were imposed at Babel. There were also, leading up to this, five primal curses. The serpent was cursed and proclaimed to be the enemy of the woman. The ground was cursed. Cain was condemned to a doubtful harvest and anxious wandering. The tribe of Canaan was sentenced to servitude, and the linguistic distinction ensued at the Tower of Babel. It is true, there had also been blessings blessings of procreation, but in relation to God, the predominance, the predominant mood, the predominant direction, if you will, was divine displeasure. And it resulted in the judgment. And all of that made for an environment of fear and uncertainty. Genesis chapter 12, verse 1, then, begins the work which will remove the doubt about God's intentions to bridge the gulf between himself and humanity. After the command to get out, God assures Abram of his intentions. I mean, if you think about it again, this is no small task for Abram. Again, it's one of the reasons it's very helpful to look back and try to, as best we can, understand where Abram was coming from in his mind. Again, I know God had to have been working with him. You don't just, okay, I'll leave everything. I mean, God walk, you know, you wake up some morning, you have some dream. God says, guess what? Get out, leave your family, go to, I don't know, somewhere in the Amazon, walk away, just get it all behind you, and I'll show you what to do when you get there. You're not likely, in some regard, relating back to the sermonette, you're not likely just to do that. But Abram was there. But God reassures him. And again, we have 11, I'll say 2,000 years, 11 chapters of a history leading up to this. And in three verses, there are five times, well, really just two verses, but five times God uses the word bless in his various forms. He says he will bless Abraham. How reassuring in a moment in a time when Abraham is looking at what do I do? You know, again, he gets a command, go. God repeatedly says, I will bless you. I will shower my goodness upon you. But you got to go. And again, it's so important to try to consider and ask the question, what is it Abraham knew at this point? See, we get the benefit of looking at this story with the rest of Scripture. Abram didn't have the rest of Scripture. Abram didn't have any Scripture. Abram had ancient stories, and he had the Word of God. I suspect he puzzled how all nations would be blessed through him. I would. Okay. Regardless, Abram embarks on the adventure that God called on him to go. And again, just like we do, everybody here at some point, you heard something, you experienced something, and God says, I want you to go. I want to put you on your adventure. So Abram is put at the trailhead. Abram was going into the unknown without a map. And as it turned out, was not to enjoy a settled abode again. He's coming from a very comfortable life. You could say he was one of the 1%ers. We'd use that term on him today. He's a very wealthy family. He was asked to walk away. If we then view this as the trailhead of hope, what are the key elements that we can glean as we look around that trailhead? What can we learn and apply to our own life? Especially, not just the trailhead, I suppose it's fair to say, if you start walking down the path towards salvation a little bit, because we go along here, because Abram's life, I think, represents both. I'm pulling you out of it, I'm putting you here. Now go. So what can we learn? The trailhead of hope has God's calling. It is started, it is initiated by the calling of God. And that's true for all of us. You were not smart enough to come up with this. You did not join this operation. You were called to it. The trailhead of salvation, the trailhead of hope has that. It also has the removal from the Babylonian system. Just like we are called to do, come out of the world. Yes, we are among it, just like Abram was. But we are not to be of it. And we'll see that brought out a little bit in some of his actions here in a minute. It has faith, because by faith, he embarked into the unknown. By faith, he stepped out into the great adventure. He did not know where he was going. I mean, he knew where he was going. Like, that's fair. Go that way. Go south. Go to Canaan. But by faith, the trailhead has that. Has an element of faith. I will believe God. He says he's going to do this. I'm going to go. Number four, it has God's promised blessing. It has God's promised blessing at the end of the adventure. And that's an important thing. Us, again, we're going to see that, not in detail, but you will see this if you read the story of Abram and you read the story of any servant of God. The blessing comes in the end. He says, I will make of you a great nation. Abram never saw that. He never saw it. There is a great promise you have, you will not see in this life, just like Abram. Everybody here has the promise of first fruits. Have you seen it? Do you know what it is? I mean, we can learn a great deal. Again, we have plenty of scripture. Abram learned what it was going to be, a great nation, as he went through his life, if you will. Never saw it. It is after Christ's return that you will see it. You will inherit. You will become an action. Be aware that, hey, this is actually the experience of first fruits. So yeah, there's a great, great promised blessing given to you. And again, it's worth considering. What do we know about it? I don't think we know much more about it in reality than what Abram knew at this point. He knew there's a promise. We can understand the words great nation. He could understand we got a great promise, and we understand the concept of first fruits. Abram didn't know of all the tribes of Israel, of all the blessings and all that was going to come of it. I mean, what, a third of the world? It's his family, his tribes. I don't think he could imagine that. The fifth element that we can learn from the trailhead is grace and blessing are sufficient for the journey. God's grace for you and his promised blessing for you is sufficient. I actually think this is one of the things that hangs up some people from considering baptism. Because they want more. They want to see something. God says, in essence, my grace is sufficient for you. Go. I promise you I will be with you. I don't know, did any of you have more than that when you got baptized? I didn't. Honestly, I didn't. I'm one of these people. I grew up in this. I'm like, I don't know, I guess it's the next thing to do. I didn't really, it's just what to do. The sixth thing I think we can glean from this, those God's graces with his presence should in turn be a blessing to others. What I would ask you, are you? You have been graced, given, blessed with God's presence. God says, I will be with you. Are you a blessing to others? God told Abram, you will be. I will ensure it. Because I'm with you, you will bless other people. Seventh, and again, I think this is more of a natural reaction, but it's still a point worth noting. Those who see and respect that God is blessing you, his servant, will in turn receive a blessing. That's important to know. You don't have to convert everybody that you bump into, but if you are acting as a God-fearing Christian, and you are acting and doing the right thing, and you can pick any simple thing. You tell the truth in a hard situation. Does that have a positive effect on somebody else that looks at you and go, there's something special about them? Do they receive a blessing because they're, you know what, next time I'm going to do that. I don't care what the consequence, I will be truthful. Whatever, and you could take that example and multiply that times 10,000 on the examples you live in your life. People that look at you and go, there's something special about them, I will emulate that, will in turn be blessed. That should be a result. It is a result God says, those who see and respect that blessing that I've given you, I will bless them. They will receive a blessing. And again, the converse of that is also true, so I separated them out, 2 points. Those who see you and curse you, God says, curse his servants, will in return receive a curse. And I think it's just the flip side of that equation. They look at you and they think you're a stupid idiot for being truthful and you got in all this trouble and whatever, whatever, whatever. And they harden their own heart and they harden and steal their own ways. They will be cursed. You go down a horrible dark path when you do that. And again, you could take that and apply it to anything. People should look at you and there will be this ripple effect out into the world. And again, it's not even people that become part of the community of God. It's just people you bump into. It could be being nice to somebody in the grocery store and the ripple effect from that. The 9th, and I couldn't come up with 10. I tried, but 9 is all I got. What God is accomplishing and his called out will result in overflowing blessing to other. And I broke that out because it can't. All nations of the earth will be blessed through a promise. We know the history. We know why that is. We know how that is. I don't know that it was explained to Abraham. But there was overflowing. There is overflowing blessing. And it is not done. There is more blessing to come through the lineage, through the seed of Abraham. This is all part of the trailhead. These are all things we can learn because God reached into your life and put you on that same trailhead toward salvation, toward his paradise. What are the next steps that Abram takes? Abram subsequently experiences are equally informative. They are equally informative as he begins his journey. Again, we kind of alluded to this. But the first experience, he actually takes the first step. He embarks on his journey. Again, just for that question, is I try to imagine him coming out of Haran, heading into the unknown. What did he know? That is, again, I know we've kind of talked through that, but that is worth reconsidering when we think about him taking the action of embarking on his journey. Once on the journey, God provides additional blessings as God sees fit. That's good to know. You're on your journey. As God deems fit, he will provide blessing. Again, I think that's reassuring. It's very comforting. Third, Abram went and pitched his tent east of Bethel in the land of Canaan. He stayed out of the system. He not only left his family, he not only left Ur of Chaldees, he not only left the comforts of home and all the protection and the safety and all the comforts that that would have afforded. Where he went, he didn't even go into the cities. He stayed out of them. The rest of his time, he tried to stay away from them. He couldn't always, but he stayed out of the system. When he got there, again, I don't know how, I actually did the math. I should have wrote it and written it down just in my notes somewhere, so I'm going to pull this from memory. But I think it's about like taking a journey from our area down to the Gulf Coast, down toward Pensacola, the distance from Haran to Canaan. I'm like, I try to imagine that on foot and how long it would have taken to get there, and you don't know where you're going. You just go down to the Gulf Coast. Okay. He gets there. First thing he does is call upon the name of the Lord. It's almost like he gets there and he said, okay, I'm here now. What does my Lord want me to do? Sometimes I think we can feel like that. We get sent on a mission. We get sent on a journey. I don't know why. Why am I here? Why am I doing this? And it's fair at the point you get there. Lord, what do you want now? And we all reach that point, whether by commission or omission, by just living your life. There's going to come a point where you reach the terebinth tree, metaphorically, and you don't know what to do. What a blessing that you get to call on the name of the Lord and say, now what? Where to now, God? Fifth, it's important to note the inevitable trials will come. In the case of Abram, it was severe famine. You know, again, I try to imagine what that's like. Man, you told me to come here. And now there's so much famine, I can't even feed my own family. It's a trial. The blessing God gives to Abraham plant the seeds that will reverse the judgments and curses of Genesis 3 through 11. Again, those curses are still being reversed. And I know in ultimate sense they will be reversed. But you can find the seeds. It's as though God reached into that moment in time and started planting little baby seeds. We see, or we read, in Genesis chapter 3, verse 17, that the ground was cursed. Abraham is promised the land to possess, a seed. The beginning phase of the reversal. Now the land will be a blessing. Now the land will be, is part of the promised gift. Cain was cursed and became a wanderer. Abraham, the wanderer, is given a home. Again, a seed that begins the reversal. Cain, the Nephilim, and the builders of Babel all sought for themselves a name. God tells Abram, I'll do that for you. In fact, it's not even just a name. I'm going to make your name great. You are going to be a great man. 4,000 years later, where much of his story is written, we're still talking about him. Salvation is brought through his line. He didn't have to claim that. He didn't have to build a city and a tower and accumulate wealth and power and everything to himself to achieve that. Everybody that did that, name one of them. Who did it? Who ruled Ur of the Chaldees at the time of Abram? I couldn't tell you. Maybe one of those 100,000 tablets somewhere has it written down. Maybe if you're a historian, you would know. I don't. But I know Abram. Cain, who built the city in the land of restlessness, it's just what the land of Nod means, and the migrants from the east who tried to build in the land of Shinar, they all discovered that they had no lasting city. Abraham, we're told, was waiting for the city with a foundation of which the builder and maker and architect was God. Permanent home. Permanent. Again, reversing the curses of the first 11 chapters. The families of the nations were scattered at Babel. It says in Abraham, all the families of the earth will be blessed. And ultimately, we see that fulfilled in the unity of Christ. Salvation's journey toward the restoration of paradise reverses all the curses whereby mankind was enslaved. And brethren, that's good to know. It's good to consider that as each one of us, again, are put on that same trail, put on that same trailhead and marching down that same path. That's why, again, I like the imagery of a trailhead. In Abraham's case, it was an untrammeled trailhead. I get that. We've got a roadmap. We've got blessings of seeing and knowing and reading the stories of men and women that have done this before and gone before us. We can learn from them. We can gain a great deal. Abram, in many ways, was forging a new trail, a new path, all marching and all working toward not just salvation in its ultimate sense, but really the restoration of paradise that God wants for mankind. The next stories we get are equally informative. Abram and Lot, they begin to contend with one another. You know, it's one of those old stories. It's been around for a long time. But yet, within the community of God, there is contention and there is separation. I suppose in one sense, the surprising thing is that every time it happens, it takes us by surprise. But it happened. Both Abram and Lot were part of the community. Those two families then, and again, this by easily is multiple sermons on its own, but they demonstrate two ways of the community of God to relate to the world. Abram and Lot. What did Lot do? Lot looked at the good things of this world and he moved in that direction. He looked at the green plains. fertile water, fertile land, fertile everything, and said, yep, that's where I'm going to move. Abraham moved his tent to a wooded oak, a terebinth tree, near Hebron, outside the city, and there he built an altar and called on the name of the Lord. The lesson that we can take away, and one of the great lessons again for Christianity and for every Christian, if you pitch your tent toward Sodom, you will become like Sodom. Brethren, let that sink in. If you set your orientation as a community member of God, Lot was, righteous Lot. If you orient your mind, if you set your mind and you set your intentions, you can read. Again, we don't have time. You can read the story of Lot. You will become like the world. It will be inevitable. Abram, again, I just like the image. Outside of town, I'm going to build an altar near a tree. Two kings come to visit Abram, and we get two options for where you should place and can ultimately place your trust. We get Melchizedek, a divine king who delivers Abram and Lot from the enemy. Sodom, the king of Sodom, a human potential protector, but they ended up in captivity. Two ways. Who are you going to trust? Ultimately, again, we would use Christ, but Melchizedek or the king of Sodom. Next story we get really gives us three ways we can deal with God's divine promise. Because Abraham now trying to figure out the impossible, trying to figure out how God's going to deliver on his promises. Again, we get three general ways in which we can view the promise. We can question it. We can ask God, why? I don't know how this is going to happen. And as a metaphorically, that's equivalent or that phase where Abraham was going through Eliezer. Even Abraham, and that's like, ah, that can't be it. And God assures him, nope, it's not going to be him. It's going to be through your line. Do we do that? We know we do. There's sometimes we get the promises of God, and we're like, oh, I don't know, you know. We can begin to approach it from a question. Again, one of three ways. Second way, we can work at it. This is a phase where you try to work out the promises of God. We see that in Ishmael. Again, where you try to figure out how to do it yourself. And then the final approach, if you will, we can have to God's promises is to believe in divine fulfillment, and that is patiently wait on God. Where there will be an outcome, as in the case of Abram, there's an outcome that you have no choice but to say that was God. The promise was delivered divinely. Isaac was born divinely. There was no explanation, no human way that was going to happen. That's what one of the reasons you can laugh about it. They did. Three different approaches. You can question how it's going to happen and wonder and do a lot of things. You can try to work it out yourself, or you can patiently wait on divine fulfillment. We then have the rest of Abram's story and the patriarchal stories of Isaac and Jacob and the 12 sons, which demonstrates the faithful generational fulfillment of God's promises. Again, it's worth noting, during his lifetime, Abram possessed only a small plot of land, which essentially was large enough to bury his wife. He never saw the land given to him. Outside of these narratives, nothing much more seems to be happening for almost 400 years, other than the descendants of Jacob becoming slaves in Egypt. Secular history takes little note of what God is doing, but patiently and quietly, God is preparing his people for the next part of the journey towards salvation. It is a period then of divine patience. The patriarchs long dead, and a man off minding his own business, living in the quiet part of his life and quiet area with his wife and family, was a man named Moses. We get a lot more information about Moses and when he was called. And God presented himself to him in the flame of a burning bush. But there are many similarities, and we'll go through this, again, not in detail, because I got 5 minutes. But there are many similarities. Both Moses and Abram were called to go and do as God commanded them. Both of them were given assurances by God that he would be with them. Both of them had stepped out on faith to embark on the adventure. Both of them repeatedly called upon the name of the Lord to know what God willed them to do. Both of them had their faith tested when things did not go as they anticipated. As we mentioned earlier, Abram had a famine. Moses, Pharaoh adds burdens. When Moses is first rejected, things go terribly bad. Israel gets, your faith is tested when everybody turns against you. Both of them were given great promises in the end that it would work out. Both wonder and question how God will see his promises fulfilled. Interestingly, both of them tried to work it out themselves. Again, I find that informative because I think it's a natural proclivity for us to be like, all right, well, I'll figure this out. You know, God promised me a peaceful life. God promised me this. God, I'm going to work that out. In fact, I could fix my spouse. They both had, again, a desire to try to work it out themselves. We mentioned Abraham with Ishmael. Moses, who killed a taskmaster, tried to work it out, tried to save, because, you know, I'm going to kill you if you're going to hurt my people. And he did not go on the mission which God commanded him initially. And again, it was very difficult. Didn't work out when he tried to do it on his own. Both of them experienced setbacks and trials, but kept their eye on the Lord. Both of them were given intermediate proof that God was with them. Again, Abram had the son of promise. I actually like Moses for some reason. I like for note takers, Exodus 3:12. Anybody remember the sign God said? Because I'd be like, come on, man. but Moses or Abraham had to wait too. You know what Moses was? Say, here's the sign I'll give you that I'm with you. And this is, you know, he's telling him to go in there and talk to Pharaoh and get the people out and do all this. The sign is, when you get here, you're going to worship me on this mountain. In essence, go do the task. Go get the job done. In the end, you'll have your sign. It's a sign of faith. See, we want to flip that. We want, God, I want proof. Don't send me without giving me the evidence you want me to go. Don't send me without, you know, whoa, and opening everybody's heart and mind, and all of a sudden the world's converted. Okay, I can go on that mission. God says, go. However long it takes. Plagues and all the disease and all the marshing and all the complaining and all this and all that. When you get here, when you bring them all here and worship, that's your sign. Again, bit of a sidebar, but I think that's interesting. Neither of them fully inherited the promises in their physical life. And again, I go back to the concept of first fruit. You will not fully inherit that in this life. But it's still a promise of God. A treasured, treasured promise. Israel then, and you know, we're going to cover like 2,000 years of history in like 3 minutes. Israel then was to be a model nation. They sort of had it under King David, but it was to be an earthly type of the heavenly paradise. That temple was literally modeled after the example we see in heaven. We have the scriptures that talk about that. Here, it's going to be like this. God was supposed to be their king. The laws were his. He was supposed to rule over them. The whole way of life was to pivot around the Lord. That was to be the design of Israel. As we know, it didn't work out. In time, the 10 tribes of Israel go into captivity and are lost to history. God eventually divorces Israel, and his glory leaves the physical temple. And eventually, the remaining 2 tribes are taken into captivity. And much like the environment, if you will, and that Abram was called and brought into sort of the salvation path, very similar to that. It is out of the ashes. It is out of the ashes of what should have been that the next major pivot point of salvation history emerges, which is signified by the words of an angel given to men that are living out in the field tending sheep. When he says, "Do not be afraid, for behold, I bring you good tidings of great joy, which will be to all people, for there is born to you this day in the city of David a Savior, who is Christ the Lord." God willing, next time we will have the opportunity to discuss that next great stage of God's plan toward our march to paradise.